involved, they should feel free to reach out to us at the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. And you also can see what these campuses now look like. When Columbia called in the NYPD, which was chomping at the bit to grab these students in case, in some of these instances quite violently, and to arrest them, you know, they refused to allow, the NYPD refused to allow the press on campus while they conducted this arrest of the students. And then they themselves put out these appalling videos of them, like, raising the American flag, tearing down Palestinian flags. I mean, just really demonstrating the eagerness and political hostility that they have to the demonstrators. And then Columbia asked the NYPD, again, larger than the military of half of the countries in the world, to occupy the campus for the next 2 weeks. So now Columbia University is occupied by the NYPD in order to suppress any pro-Palestinian dissent. This is demonstrative of the university's views of their students. They're actually now having, they're shutting down commencements, they're shutting down speakers, they have canceled speakers across the country like USC. They're doing everything they can to stop people from being able to express themselves, including inviting in paramilitary police forces to become occupying forces on their campuses. That's the state of American universities and academic freedom and free speech. They can teach what they want in the classroom, but the reality is what we're seeing in the street.
Mara, we're so glad that the protesters around the country have you on their side. Thanks for your important work.
Thank you for having me.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized.
One of the great events of the 60s was the Columbia student takeover of several buildings on their campus, protesting the university's complicity in the war against the Vietnamese people, and their racist action in building a gym in a public park in Harlem adjacent to Columbia. The student actions at Columbia brought down a terrific repression. 700 students were arrested and beaten in May of 1968. Our own Michael Ratner, a co-founder of Law and Disorder and a law student at Columbia at the time, was also beaten by the police. For Michael, there was no turning back. He went on to become one of the great movement lawyers of his generation. We speak today with his friend and Columbia University student, anti-war Vietnam activist Eleanor Stein. Like Michael, she was at the law school. Eleanor Stein went on to become an attorney and a law professor in Albany, specializing in climate law. We will be speaking with her on the similarities between the repression at Columbia 56 years ago and the current repression. Eleanor Stein, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
Eleanor, what brought you into the anti-war movement at Columbia in 1968?
It's hard to conjure up those months and that year for people who didn't live through it, but 1968 was the high tide of the Vietnam War. In 1967, over 9,000 Americans had been killed, and of course, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese. And in 1968, that number would almost double to over 15,000. And in January of that year was the Tet Offensive, where the Vietnamese, who were fighting to get rid of the Americans and take over their own country and their own government, took over dozens of provincial capitals and many other towns and cities in Vietnam, including the American Embassy for quite a while. And at home, it was May 4th, 1968, that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And cities all over the country, every inner city, exploded in rebellion in African-American communities. And tanks were rolling down the streets of Washington, D.C. So it's just a reminder of what the context was for us at that moment. And I was a first-year law student at Columbia. I was sitting in contracts class with my best friend, Gus Reichbach, who we'll be talking about. We heard people chanting outside, and Gussie said, "Hey, let's get out of here." We left, we ran outside, and the Students for Democratic Society and Students African American Society were staging a march over from the campus to the site of what was supposed to be an exclusive gymnasium for the use of Columbia only, that was going to be located in Morningside Park, one of the probably the largest open green space in Harlem. So our protest against that was we had signs that said "Stop Jim Crow," but it was G-Y-M Crow, and people marched over to the gym site and were chanting, and then somebody climbed over the fence and sat down in front of the bulldozers, and we were off.
Now, Eleanor, Columbia students also took over several buildings on the campus those 56 years ago. They occupied the Lowe Memorial Library, where the president's office is located, and also Hamilton Hall, which they lately have occupied. What were the demands and the issues at the heart of this?
You know, the issues at the heart of it were the great moral issues of the day, just like today. One of the issues was stopping the construction of the gym, which was clearly seen as a racist enterprise. There was going to be a back door down at the bottom of the hill. Morningside Park, for those who don't know, is a steep hill. Harlem's at the bottom. Columbia, symbolically, is at the top. And there was going to be exclusive for Columbia use, but there was going to be a back door where members of the community could use, you know, occasionally. So one of the demands was stop the construction of the gym. The second demand was linked to the Vietnam War. There was an institution on campus called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was a Department of Defense contractor that entered into agreements with universities and others to do research and do studies and scientific work for the war effort. And once we found out that the war was actually there in our campus, that our university was complicit in the Vietnam War, we focused on that target. And the specific demand was get the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, off the campus and stop the construction of the gym. Those are the core demands. And then, of course, as the demonstrations escalated, we, as students are doing today, we added the demand for amnesty, that protesters not be penalized for their participation in the protest.
Yes. There was a massive crackdown at Columbia in 1968. How is this repression similar to what's happened lately at Columbia?
Well, it's amazing to watch this. It's so much like going back to one's youth. So in 1968, there were about 750 students arrested. About 150 were sent to the hospital. The weapon of choice at that time was the old-fashioned billy club, and a lot of students were beaten. Our friend Gus Rushback was badly beaten in the head, was concussed. Many other students were beaten. There's many pictures of students with blood pouring down their faces. And then the university pursued disciplinary action against students who had been arrested, and especially the leadership. So today, I think it was roughly 200 or 230 students were arrested, ironically, on the very same day, April 30th, 56 years later. And my impression is that the police used concussive grenades in the buildings to kind of scare everybody and, you know, subdue the students. But I think the students, as far as I can tell, they certainly didn't do anything to provoke that kind of violence and that kind of repression. As I understand it, they, and as we all saw on television, they simply walked out of the building in a very disciplined way, handcuffed with zip ties behind their backs, which apparently people had to, were kept in zip ties for 7 or 8 hours, very painful and dangerous procedure.
Eleanor, how is Columbia President Shafeek and its board of trustees complicit in today's assault on Gaza? I know that neither she nor any other college president across the country has condemned Israel's bombing of every single university in Gaza.
So glad that you raised that issue. I think it's really central, although it you don't see it in the press. You hear it on Democracy Now!, you hear it on this show. But I know Naomi Klein and I think others are calling this scholasticide in Gaza. Every university has been reduced to rubble. Thousands and thousands of students have been killed. Schools have been destroyed. Museums have been destroyed. Archives have been destroyed. Really hundreds, maybe thousands of years of history of the Palestinian people is being obliterated, as well as, of course, you know, 35,000 people. But the systematic and clearly intentional and planned destruction of the educational infrastructure of Gaza is, in itself, is a war crime of its own, the destruction of a people's history and culture. And the students are raising this, scholasticide, students are raising this, but I have not seen university administrators, university trustees, university presidents expressing any sense of responsibility or empathy or concern even for their colleagues in Gaza. So I think that has contributed to the sense of the students that they are, it's up to them. And I think we are all seeing that it is indeed up to them, that they are up to that challenge.
Eleanor Stein, the Board of Trustees at Columbia is made up of very rich people. It's been observed that the president of the university takes its orders from them. Do you agree?
Well, I think that's generally true, and I think the trustees are a factor. I think the finances of the university, and we don't know really the extent to which either Israeli forces or pro-Zionist forces are, or foundations, or governmental support. We don't know the extent to which it's embedded in the life of Columbia, but I have a feeling that it's greatly and deeply embedded. And, of course, President Shafeek herself is apparently pulling down a very healthy salary, somewhere in the millions, so much so that her former colleagues in the British House of Lords were shocked and astonished to hear what her salary was going to be to go to Columbia. But more broadly, I remember in 1968, NACLA, North American Congress on Latin America, put out what I think was one of its very first reports, which was called Who Rules Columbia? And to this day, it's a classic of kind of root cause analysis. And it tracks major corporations, major foundations, other entities that were central to the running of Columbia. I think there were media conglomerates central to the running of Columbia. So it really painted the classic picture of the kind of octopus tentacles of corporate America running and dictating policy to this university. And I think I know that people are doing that research today. I'm sure they have done it. And I think we're going to see a very similar pattern.
Eleanor, in your opinion, did the repression of Columbia students back in 68, especially by law enforcement, backfire? And what do you think the result of the current nationally courted crackdown will be?
You know, when we were in the buildings, and I'll just clarify, the first building that was occupied in 1968 was Hamilton Hall, as today, which is a classroom building. And it was held by the Student Afro-American Society. And then the white students left and took over eventually four other buildings, three classroom buildings, and one administration building, low library. And in the 7 days that we held those five buildings, and by the way, flew red flags from the roof of every one of them, a truly stirring sight. The campus was split. There were a lot of students who supported us. There were a lot of students who were very annoyed and angry and resentful that they're, you know, it was the end of the semester, it was the spring. Where was their chance to play Frisbee on the campus? And where was their chance to finish out their classes? And so there were a lot of students who students who were kind of neutral. They agreed with our aims, but they thought we had gone a little far, and they didn't like being locked out of their classes. And then, of course, there was an organized right-wing opposition in which the athletic students, as we call them, the jocks, played a leading role, and they maintained a kind of a cordon around the occupied buildings to prevent people from coming in and out, to prevent people from bringing us food and communications. And the faculty was, I'd say, on the whole, rather neutral. There were a handful. Eric Foner had just started his academic career. He was very supportive. There was a handful who were supportive, and many were opposed. However, once police came on campus on April 30th, 1968, and dragged the students out, and media was not banned from the campus. They learned that lesson. Later, widely seen, widely televised, the sentiment on campus changed dramatically, and the level of support for the students became almost universal. And there was actually a general strike of students and university employees after the bust in support of the students. And it was impossible for the university to go on functioning. And they didn't function. They basically closed. Everyone, you know, became pass. It was pass fail. Exams were canceled. I think graduation was moved indoors, but I think it was kind of a fiasco. Our mutual dear friend Michael Ratner ended up graduating first in his class, partly because the last semester of his stay there was pass fail, so he didn't even have to do any work. I teased him about that till the end of his life. So I think the same thing is happening now. And the revulsion of students and the revulsion of faculty at having their campus, basically their campus is now under occupation by the police. Thousands and thousands of police, and they're going to stay there, the president announced, until May 17th, which is actually after graduation. So they're now living in occupied territory, and I don't think they like it one bit. So I think the tide of public opinion in the university, and I think we're seeing this everywhere, has changed dramatically because of the incursion of the police.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with law professor Eleanor Stein, who's a veteran of the Columbia sit-down and student strike back in 1968. Eleanor, Columbia President Shafiq called in the New York Police Department for a second time. She'd been collaborating with the FBI. On April 30th, police in riot gear arrived at the Columbia campus. How do you appreciate the fact that she wrote a letter requesting that they break up the encampment? In the letter, she said that the university had been vandalized and she was protecting the students and their right to free speech. How do you appreciate that?
I would say that it's basically a pack of lies, in a word. You know, to me, the discipline and care of the students in that encampment, and I think this is generally true across the country, and I've seen it on other campuses myself in the last few weeks, is remarkable and is really praiseworthy in the face of tremendous provocation by the university and by students and others who are supporting the Zionist genocide in Gaza. The most ironic thing in her letter is that she says she's trying to protect the students and trying to protect their right to free speech. So just to be clear, weeks ago, after completely peaceful demonstrations and rallies on the campus, Columbia banned two organizations, two of the leading organizations in support of Gaza, the Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. She banned them from the campus. And you would see on the campus, there would be one table in the middle of the campus with one person holding up a photograph of an Israeli baby and a sign about October 7th. And that was the only voice that was allowed on the campus. And the idea that she's protecting free speech is, it's really breathtaking in its duplicity. Because, I mean, I've never seen, I can't remember anything comparable to this. They, you know, they were not being banned because they had broken any of the multitude of university rules or laws. They were banned because they were supporting the Palestinians. And that speech was banned on the campus. And I will say, Columbia was not alone. I gave a talk at NYU in November on climate change, which is my field, and I asked to be introduced as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, just as a way to say, let's not forget this is happening. And I actually was speaking about the relationship between climate change and the incursion in Gaza. And two representatives of the law school came to see me. They literally took me into the proverbial back room and said, you can't say that on this campus. NYU has banned those words, and it has banned any discussion of Israel and Palestine. And I was really astonished. I mean, I knew they didn't like it. I knew they what side they were on, but I was really astonished. How can a law school ban, is it the word Jewish? Is it the word voice? Maybe it's the word peace. That was so terrifying. So to me, that just exemplified what Columbia, NYU, and many other universities are doing, which is they will go to any lengths to prevent an open discussion of the merits of what Israel is doing. And I think that that's her protecting the right to free speech. So I think that the best thing I can say is that what she did has really alienated not only the student body, but the faculty, which is now up in arms against her leadership.
Eleanor, at the George Washington University campus, which is just a few blocks from the White House, the campus president asked the local D.C. police to come on campus and break up their encampment. But to their credit, the top brass at the police department and the mayor of D.C. refused. What do you make of that?
I appreciate what they did enormously, and it's very unusual. But I will say even the New York Police Department, after the first round of arrests at Columbia, did make a statement saying that they didn't see any reason for these arrests. Students were not breaking any laws. They didn't see any, you know, any violent behavior or any illegal behavior. So it's just ironic that the gap in reality between the reality of what law enforcement is seeing and the kind of surreal vision of what's going on that's being pervaded by the leadership of our universities is very ironic. And I will say, I haven't seen any evidence of any violence or anything other than, you know, basic civil disobedience, clearly exercise of First Amendment rights, clearly within the law, really at Columbia or really anywhere. And I think we're in a situation now where the greatest threat is that we have, at Columbia, for example, thousands of armed police on the campus now for 3 more weeks. And I think that's a very dangerous situation because that alone can lead to violence. That alone can lead to provocation. And, you know, I hope that this period ends at Columbia without anything worse happening to the students.
Eleanor, it's really been illuminating to compare what happened those years ago and what's happening now on campuses. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, actually, I would suggest that the best way to follow what's going on is by watching Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, which is doing fantastic coverage and is featuring Juan Gonzalez, who is their co-host and who was a leader of the Columbia protest in 1968. So that would be my recommendation.
Well, unfortunately, Eleanor Stein, we've come to an end to our allotted time, so Heidi and I are going to have to say goodbye, but we truly appreciate your participation in Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Same to you. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Dr. Oscar Radoli, bringing you the best mix of music.
Bring us life. It's like when you were at work and you said to yourself, you know, I'm going to have a good time tonight. I'm going to go out to you. So you put on your favorite shoes or you put on your favorite jeans. You get into the mood. You pull up to the club. It's a long line, but you don't care because you can hear the thump outside those doors. And you get that feeling all over again, and you get that chill up your spine because the DJ's playing your favorite songs back to back, and you're not in yet, but soon you know you're gonna be. Oh, man, what's that feeling called again? What's that feeling called when finally you're in and you're standing in the middle of the floor and you open your arms real wide to accept those vibes, all those positive vibes, and your family's there and all those people that are experiencing the same thing that you are experiencing at that moment in time. What's that called again? What's that called when 1 minute you're on one side of the room and the next minute you're on the other and you're not quite sure how you got there, but you know somehow, some way you travel through the sound and you did some twists and some turns and next thing you know you're upside down and oh man, what's that called again? Whatever it is. Starts beating faster and faster and your beat keeps moving and you know you should sit down but you can't because the DJ just started playing them Afro sounds, you know those Afro sounds, the bongos and congas and the shake, shake, shake. Some people call it a blessing, some people call it a disease because it spreads around like an epidemic, you know, and it brings you to your knees and there's no cure. We'll be right back.
OC, bringing you the Afro swag on Timbo Sounds.
Pague mal, Timbo Sounds a Culture. Yeah.